This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm your host, Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available on podcasts. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There are now more ways to stay in touch with DC 37. We're on social media. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net, and you can call our hotline for up-to-the-minute information about what's going on at the union, 212-815-7555. If you have any comments about this or any other show that we do, drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Your feedback is always welcome. With the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King just behind us, tonight we're going to discuss the relationship between Dr. King and Senator Robert Kennedy, who would be assassinated just over 2 months later in June of 1968. Joining us is author David Margolick, who has written a book called The Promise and the Dream, The Untold Story of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy. Welcome to State of the Union, sir.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris. Thank you.
I just want to start this talking about this book. You had a meeting at the Mayflower Hotel with Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, who, as you say, graciously agreed to see you. And she said to you, quote, "Just because two people live at the same time and are engaged in two different worlds and talk to each other 10 times during the course of their lives or 20 times does not make a book." I think you've proven her wrong.
Well, I wrote 120,000 words for this non-book.
and what was her point?
I think her point was that these two guys didn't rub up against each other. They didn't see each other all that much. They weren't friends. They didn't talk to one another all that frequently, and that while people wanted to tie the two of them together, there really wasn't that much of a connection. And so please don't do the book. There's no book here.
And you've come away thinking that she was wrong and the book exists. And what were you trying to do with this book?
Well, I knew that it really didn't matter whether these two men were pals and whether they were frequent correspondents or talking on the phone regularly, that they were in the same world and that they were very important to one another and they rubbed up against one another and that their lives were very profoundly intertwined for a period of several years in the 1960s. I mean, inevitably, when one man is attorney general and therefore sort of the custodian of civil rights in this country, and the other man is the foremost civil rights leader, they're going to have a relationship. And the fact that they didn't speak to one another all that often and kept a certain distance from one another was no accident. And part of the story, was to explain why they didn't have more of a relationship. They were acutely aware of one another and watching one another and conscious of what one another was doing. And that's a form of relationship. And so I wanted to document that. I wanted to explain the ways in which they interacted and the ways in which they didn't and how they felt about one another, since they would have spent a lot of time thinking about one another. So in that sense, their lives were profoundly overlapping. And then after Robert Kennedy was Attorney General, after the assassination of his brother, he becomes United States Senator, and Martin Luther King goes through his own evolution. And, you know, you have at the end, you have Bobby Kennedy giving the most famous eulogy of all for Martin Luther King. And one has to explain how the same man who approved a wiretap on Dr. King ended up eulogizing him. I mean, that's quite a journey.
Yes.
And if there's a journey, there's a story. And if there's a story, there's a book.
There is, you know, as someone who grew up, I was, I think, 10 years old in 1968. But my grandmother, my aunts, they always had John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. There were portraits always on the walls. And to certain families, you know, in this country, the three of them were really bound together.
Yeah.
And so to so many of us, it was about the hope that these three guys had.
Yeah, yeah. It's very striking. You know, I mean, I've seen these objects. For a time, I was going on Amazon or eBay and buying them. You know, ashtrays and wall hangings and tapestries and plates with the Holy Trinity on there with the two Kennedys and Martin Luther King. I think that probably 95% of those were in black homes.
Really?
Right. They were in black homes. They were the people. It was in the black community that these three men were tied together most profoundly. And so I think it's no accident that, you know, you had relatives that had these objects around the house.
Right. Well, I'm also struck. The book reminds me of so much. I mean, the book just makes me remember so much. And one of the things that I don't think I really appreciated was that in 1956, when Eisenhower gets elected, he gets elected with a majority of the black vote.
Yeah, well, it's hard to remember that the blacks had this historic association with the Republican Party going back to Abraham Lincoln. I mean, it's laughable now when some Republican trots out that we're the party of Abraham Lincoln. But back then, you know, Jackie Robinson was an Eisenhower Republican. Okay. And the black vote was really up for grabs in 1960, and arguably, and it's a story that I tell in the book.
Well, let's talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Martin Luther King elected John Kennedy.
Right, and the black vote elected. John
I mean, that's
Kennedy.
Right, the black vote.
And
right.
But Nixon had a good shot at that. Talk a little bit about what the environment was, what the strategy was, whether Kennedy was driven by a deep-rooted feeling for black people, or whether or not this was a political strategy?
Well, the Kennedys had very little association with the black community, and they were thought to be hostile in some quarters to black America. I mean, John Kennedy had voted against an important provision of the Civil Rights Bill in 1957. They were very, you know, Massachusetts was, I mean, Martin Luther King and Andrew Young and people like that used to say that in Massachusetts, even the maids were white. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, there wasn't a huge black community there. And the Kennedys didn't really interact much with that community and had very little sort of intuitive feel for it. Oddly enough, Robert Kennedy had more of one for reasons that we can discuss. I mean, Robert Kennedy sort of feeling like the runt of the litter and the underdog in the family. And there was a black housekeeper in Hyannisport who had a couple of kids that Robert Kennedy played with. That was almost his most profound encounter with black America, you know, as a child. But there was very little sort of intuitive connection between the Kennedys and the black community, and John Kennedy himself and Robert Kennedy also had sort of catered to the black vote, to the white Southern vote. I mean, I have stories about the very enthusiastic reception that Robert Kennedy got visiting Alabama in the late 1950s. The white segregationist governor, you know, sort of laying out the red carpet for him. You know, they were looking for the Southern vote for in the 1960 presidential campaign, and the black.
So they've got a problem, though. They've got to get the black vote and the Southern and the white Southern.
Yeah, that's
vote.
Right. I mean, they really had a problem, and they were walking a tightrope, and they didn't want to antagonize the Southern white vote, but the black vote was up for play, and there were people in the Kennedy campaign that realized that we need to go after that too.
And how did they do that?
Well, they did it. I mean, they did it. They managed to get some black advisors, and there were more blacks in the Kennedy campaign than in other prior Democratic campaigns. I mean, most notably, they did it by springing Martin Luther King from jail. I mean, there's this famous episode in 1960 where on some sort of trumped up parole violation, Martin Luther King is thrown into this Georgia prison. Certain people in the Kennedy campaign realized that there were points to be scored by trying to get him out of prison. Over, incidentally, Bobby Kennedy's opposition. Bobby Kennedy felt this is going to lose the Southern white vote, and we really don't want to, you know, we have to keep our distance from Martin Luther King. We can't be seen to be in bed with him.
Which was exactly, I think you say in the book, what Richard Nixon was doing.
Right? Right.
Richard Nixon did not want to go near this. So, in fact, Bobby Kennedy was closer to Richard Nixon in thinking about
this.
Well,
and in fact, Richard Nixon was more progressive than John Kennedy on race matters. Richard Nixon was a member of the NAACP, you know? I mean, it's hard to imagine this, but the Kennedys were really quite conservative on this and very, very cautious on it. But they also had sharp political instincts, and I guess they must have felt that things were changing. And so John Kennedy ended up calling Coretta King and saying, you know, if there's any, I realize that your husband is in jail, and, you know, and I know that you're expecting a child, and this must be very hard for you, and please let us know if there's anything that we can do. And the word got out in the black community that Kennedy had made this call, and then Robert Kennedy turned around. Robert Kennedy was an interesting guy. I mean, he had his political instincts were at war with one another in a way. On the one hand, he was wary of identifying too closely with black America. But on the other hand, I think he sensed that things were changing. And he also had a clearer sense of right and wrong than I think John Kennedy did. So Robert Kennedy ended up calling up the judge in the case and getting Martin Luther King out of jail. This was an enormous story in the African American community. It was all over the black press, and the black vote came out in record number. Daddy King ended up dropping his endorsement of Richard Nixon and endorsing John Kennedy. And there were flyers distributed to black churches the Sunday before the election, hundreds of thousands of flyers, you know, supporting John Kennedy. And in various states in the North, the black vote came out in record numbers and arguably swung the election.
So Kennedy gets the election, and now what does Martin Luther King want?
Well, Martin Luther King is terribly alarmed. His first reaction is horror at the thought that Robert Kennedy is the Attorney General, because Robert Kennedy. And it's an interesting story. I talked to Harry Belafonte about this. It's really an interesting story that Robert Kennedy, of course, had worked for Senator Joe McCarthy.
Right.
And, you know, that made him very suspect in liberal eyes. You know, he was thought to be sort of a hatchet man and a red baiter and, you know, an ultra prosecutor. And oblivious to civil liberties, and made him anathema to large numbers of the white liberal community who had never gotten over his father, you know, and his father's sort of arguably Nazi sympathies or at least appeasement oriented, you know, thinking. And so Bobby Kennedy was suspect in the white community, but even more to African-Americans, McCarthyism posed a particular problem. Because many of the civil rights leaders, the most important people in the black community, like W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson, were leftists, communists even, I mean, or at least travelers, if not actual. I mean, Du Bois actually later joined the party. So they had a particular reason. They thought that McCarthy was a racist, among other things, and that anti-communism was a mask for racism. And so Martin Luther King was horrified that Robert Kennedy was the custodian of civil rights in this country. But at the same time, he realized we have to work with him. Everything related to civil rights is going to pass by him. We have to get along with him. And there's a famous meeting that Harry Belafonte described to me and also describes in his memoirs, where King gathered all of his aides and said, I want you to find Robert Kennedy's moral center, and don't come back until you've found it, because we have to deal with him.
Talking with David Moglick, who's the author of The Promise and the Dream, The Untold Story of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. Our guest this evening is David Moglick, whose new book, The Promise and the Dream, The Untold Story of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, explores a pretty complicated relationship. And we were just talking before the break about King's distrust of Kennedy. And there's a character who has to be brought into this conversation. That's J. Edgar Hoover.
Right.
Because J. Edgar Hoover, and maybe I've jumped around chronologically, but J. Edgar Hoover, you say in the book that J. Edgar Hoover was a friend of the Kennedys.
Originally, yeah.
And then that goes south, and Hoover hates King, and King is having a troubled relationship with Kennedy and with Hoover.
Right.
I may not be telling this right, but
they're crawling all over each other. Yeah, they're very much in one another's lives. Yeah. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Bobby Kennedy invited Hoover to his wedding.
And Hoover didn't go.
Hoover didn't go, right.
And Hoover doesn't
trust. But Bobby Kennedy was sort of buttering up J. Edgar Hoover often in the 1950s and saying, I think he had his picture hanging on his office wall. Bobby Kennedy was a tough law and order kind of guy, and I think he admired Hoover and he sought Hoover's favor.
And when is Hoover distrusting King or hating King, and how is that?
He only goes after King when King really starts to matter. And I think that it takes him a little while to figure out that King is the most important, is becoming the most important civil rights leader in the country. And that happens in the late 1950s.
I'm fascinated by the fact that I was thinking about this as I was reading the book. I'm on social media a lot, and a lot of folks on social media are feeling as if the world is in a place, unprecedented territory.
Yeah, right.
But authority has been used against the people before. To be black in America is to understand that the times we're in now.
You have extra sort of perspective on things, and you realize there have been terrible times before and that the law is not always your friend.
And how bad was it?
I'm still amazed that the FBI building in Washington is named after J. Edgar Hoover. It just astonishes me every time I see it. And the FBI, I gather, is moving out to Virginia or Maryland or somewhere in the burbs. and that building is going to be torn down. And I think that'll be a wonderful day when that building is torn down and his name is taken off it. And I can't imagine that the new FBI building will be named after him. And therein lies a story about American political evolution.
Right.
You know, that the African American Museum is just a mile or so away
from the
J. Edgar Hoover building.
So does Hoover's extremism push Kennedy towards King in some way, or have I got?
Well, I think that it's complicated because Hoover is monitoring King, and Hoover is feeding the Kennedys all the stuff that he's learning, and the Kennedys are sort of lapping it up, and Hoover is trying to convince the Kennedys that Martin Luther King is a communist, or at least has communists hanging around him and kibitzing with him and, you know, giving him advice, and that some of his most important advisors are communists. And he's driving a wedge between King and the Kennedys. And the Kennedys realize that for their own political survival, they have to keep a certain distance from King. So Hoover is making trouble. And Hoover is dividing the Kennedys from King and doing his best to create a distance between them and create distrust between them.
And how bad does it get for Martin Luther King?
Well, I mean, you know, it gets his phones are tapped. He's being followed. You know, they're following him into his hotel rooms. They're bugging his lawyers. They're bugging his advisors. They're sending tape recordings to him. They're trying to convince him to commit suicide.
They really did that.
They really did all of that. I mean, it's a horrifying story.
And how did they try to convince him to commit suicide?
They sent him a so-called anonymous tape. Apparently, trying to simulate the voice of a black man saying, King, your days are over. You know, the only good solution for you is to kill yourself. And this is a tape that's sent to King's home and that his wife that Coretta King ends up listening to.
And it's sent by?
It's sent by the FBI. It's sent by the top brass at the FBI.
And Bobby Kennedy knows this is happening?
Bobby Kennedy knows a lot of this. Probably didn't know that particular thing that was happening, but knew that the FBI was all over him and didn't do anything to stop it.
So on the morning of April 4th, 1968, what is the relationship between Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy?
Well, by then it's gotten actually quite attenuated. The two of them were very interrelated as long as Bobby was attorney general. And once John Kennedy is assassinated, Bobby serves as attorney general for the next year and then leaves and runs for the Senate. And once he's in the Senate, they really don't interact that much anymore. King doesn't have to petition Bobby Kennedy. He doesn't have to kisses you know what anymore.
Right,
you know,
right.
He doesn't have to ask Bobby Kennedy for things anymore. And Bobby Kennedy has very little sway over King. So at that point, one would think that they were sort of freer to be allies. And they're pushing the same causes. I mean, Bobby Kennedy becomes increasingly identified with the African American community. You know, for the same reason that you described before, Chris, that Bobby Kennedy has inherited the incredible love in the black community for John Kennedy. And the black vote becomes his most important constituency, really. And at the same time, Bobby Kennedy becomes increasingly wary, increasingly skeptical about the war in Vietnam. And so King and Kennedy are really pushing the same things in 1965, 1966, 1967, and yet there's still this distance between them. Bobby Kennedy has political aspirations, presidential aspirations. He still can't identify too much with Martin Luther King, And so at this point, they're not overlapping all that much. I mean, one of the challenges that I had in doing the book was to find a picture of the two of them together. I mean, this is an interesting thing. There are no pictures of the two of these guys alone together. There are group pictures of them in which they both appear. There was the famous meeting in June of 1963 at the White House where there's a group picture. And you can see that Bobby Kennedy looks very pleased and in the picture smiling. And Martin Luther King looks as if he can't get away quickly enough. And why is that? You know, it's because John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and the Assistant Attorney General have all just told Martin Luther King to drop Stanley Levison, his chief advisor, because he's allegedly a communist. In fact, he hadn't really been a communist for several years, but they're saying you have to get rid of him. And King is, you know, King is told that he's got to lop off his most important advisor. And so understandably, he looks very uneasy in the picture.
Yeah, I've got a note here.
Yeah.
To ask you, who was Stanley Levison?
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting story. I'm just writing a piece about him now. He was a white Jewish lawyer businessman in New York who had been one of King's advisors dating back to the Montgomery bus boycott and wore many, many hats for Martin Luther King and really arguably was his life coach. His book editor, his tax advisor, his public relations consultant, his speechwriter. He was doing 100 different things for Martin Luther King, and yet, and this is something I'm really curious about, has kind of been airbrushed out of history. And so, with all these King commemorations in the last couple of weeks, I doubt whether anybody saw a single picture of him, and it's an interesting question to me why he's become, you know, so invisible.
Is that because, I don't know when they split company, but there were other folks around who became, you know, Ralph Abernathy, Jesse Jackson, these are all fellows who were thought of as being key to King's.
You know something, I mean, I'd correct you on one thing. King could never drop him, even though the Kennedys leaned on him to drop him. He was too indispensable, and they were too connected to one another. They were profoundly connected to one another, and Levison was by King's side until the day King died.
We've got to cut this short because I got to wrap up this show. David Marglick is going to join. The second part of this conversation is going to be next week right here on 91.5 WNYE on State of the Union. So, you know, and you can pick this up on the website. You can pick it up on the podcast. But we've got to cut this. This is a fascinating conversation. We're going to keep it going. I'm just going to close this show with an announcement to find out the latest about issues impacting our union. Please attend an organizing department meeting at your job site. For dates and locations, call 212-815-1095. Again, we're talking with David Marglick. The conversation continues next week. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. Till next time, ciao. We'll be right back.